Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The system of federal background checks remains the primary gun control policy in the U.S. The FBI, which operates the system, says that the background checks help keep people safe while assuring legal access to firearms. But President Obama in early January called for something more, a beefed up system that would be more responsive to growing demands for guns and more reflective of how guns are acquired in the U.S. His call came after a record-breaking year for the American firearms industry, with gun sales hitting the highest level on record. Today, we're talking about how the system of background checks works, how Ohio compares to other states, and what the president is calling for to change the system, to improve it, in his opinion. Joining us in the studio is gun rights attorney Michael R. Moran. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
And joining us by phone is director of the Center for Research in Crime and Justice at New York University School of Law, James Jacobs. Welcome to the show, Professor Jacobs.
It's a pleasure.
I guess the term background check means different things when used in different contexts. So let's begin with that definition. What is a gun background check, Michael Moran?
Well, when we talk about the federally mandated background check that people typically associate with the purchase of a gun, we're talking about a search of a federally operated database operated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, in Clarksburg, West Virginia, and that's called NICS, or the National Instant Check System, which actually is a database which pushes and pulls data from a variety of other federal, state, and local entities.
Professor Jacobs, what's the history? When was a background check introduced in the United States?
Well, this came with the Brady Law in 1993. So it said that a dealer, you know, has to submit the name and identity information of a purchaser to the FBI and give them an opportunity to block a sale. They set up an online system. Most of what they check is your criminal record to see whether you've ever been convicted of a felony or of a misdemeanor domestic violence, but they also check to see if you've ever been involuntarily committed to a mental hospital. And there are a few other disqualifications, but the main disqualification is a criminal history.
Any criminal history?
Any felony and misdemeanor domestic violence.
There's the Gun Control Act of 1968. What was that about, Professor Jacobs?
Well, that did disqualify people who had a criminal record,
okay.
But there was no, but it was really a voluntary. There was no background check connected to it. The person had to fill out a form that they were eligible when they went into the gun store to buy a gun, and after they filled out the form and declared that they were eligible, they were able to buy the firearm.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history, the effectiveness, proposed changes to the background checks for gun purchases in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question, or if you have a comment there. My guests, James Jacobs, director of the Center for Research in Crime and Justice at New York University School of Law, and also with me here in the studio, Michael R. Moran. He's a gun rights attorney from Gahanna and also an adjunct professor for the Capital University Paralegal Program. So, Michael Moran, let's say I walk into a licensed gun store and ask to buy a gun. What's the process here in Central Ohio?
Okay, well, first, when you talk about a licensed gun store, the technical term of art is a lot of acronyms in this business, mm-hmm. is what's called an FFL, and that's a federal firearms license that is issued by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. It's a federal license which authorizes a individual, corporation, or other type of legal entity to operate essentially a retail firearms business and to be able to sell firearms to end users.
And when we say retail, we're not just talking about at the curb. We're talking online too, right?
Well, okay, the whole issue, there's so much misinformation there. So I don't even want to address the issue of, quote, online sales right now. I want to stay on topic with your original question, was what happens when I go into a gun dealer. If you walk into a federal firearms licensee in Ohio as an Ohioan and you it's a business, so they offer to sell, and if you accept, there's a deal, then there has to actually occur what's known as a legal transfer of the firearm, and that is a legal term of art defined under federal law. And in order for a legal transfer to occur between the – in other words, you can pay for the gun, but it can't be transferred to you until the law is complied with. And the first thing that's required is the transferee or the buyer of the gun has to fill out a form which is known as the ATF form 4473, and that is a firearms transaction record over the counter. And it's promulgated by federal law, and it contains demographic information. The first 10 questions contain demographic data on who are you, physical description, last name, first name, middle name, your current residence address, date and place of birth, as well as a physical description of height, weight, gender, birth date. Social security number is actually optional, and they also do collect ethnicity and race.
And they also ask, are you a fugitive from justice, as if?
Well, and now you're getting ahead of me here. First 10 questions are demographic. The next questions are deriving eligibility to possess a firearm under federal or state law, and that includes questions like, are you the actual transferee or buyer of the firearm? That goes to the issue of what we would call a straw purchase. Are you buying it for someone else or actually buying it for that couldn't pass a background check, or are you buying it? And then, as you said, are you a fugitive from justice? Now, if someone says no, then they're considered eligible, but they still have to undergo the NICS check. And the NICS check will detect generally if someone has a federal, state, or local arrest warrant, which has been issued by authority and put into the National Crime Information System, the NCIC system, which is one of the databases which is checked by NICS, by the FBI, to determine eligibility to possess or accept transfer of a firearm.
So, Professor Jacobs, what is the genesis of this form? How did they come up with this series of questions? First, the demographics, then this litany of questions to determine whether or not you're eligible or not.
Well, I don't know the history of the form, but in the legislation, set up so that if you were ineligible, and that was the ineligibility factors, like the fugitive or the criminal record or having been involuntarily committed to a mental hospital, the other stuff is needed for identification purposes. Mm-hmm. And I guess that came from the ATF itself.
Back in 1993, when the Brady Law went into effect, or when it was, let's say, prior to it being going into effect, when it was being debated in Congress, was there opposition to the law?
Yeah, the Brady Act was very controversial. There was a lot of opposition. It took, I think, 7 years to get it passed, and of course the assassination attempt on President Reagan. And when it was passed, you had President Clinton in the White House, and you had a Democratic majority in both the Senate and the House. So it was a major political battle.
Did they? I mean, so was it a political battle over the background checks in and of themselves, or was there more to the Brady Bill originally that was compromised on?
I think the major opposition was over the background checking system.
Huh.
If I could interject
Michael
something,
Moran,
yeah. I'm not a political historian. That's been a number of years ago, but there was that was a pretty wide-ranging piece of legislative real estate mm-hmm. that this covered, and I believe the so-called assault weapon ban that was passed in 1994 was also
a controversial
connected
topic.
Well, yeah, and connected to the Brady Bill. My recollection
it wasn't connected to the Brady but that came you know, after the bridge.
Was that a year later? Okay, thank you for correcting. Okay. Well, the professor is, I stand corrected on that subject.
That's why we have people like the professor.
Yeah, the Brady Bill, was it, I'm trying to think what else was included in it other than the background checks, because they had the assault weapon ban and then the Lautenberg Amendment. Was the Lautenberg Amendment on the Brady Bill then?
But that was much later. The Lautenberg thing was on the gun show.
Oh, that's right. Okay. The Lautenberg Amendment was what added the misdemeanor domestic violence offenders to disqualified possessors.
So, right. That was some years later.
So, Michael Moran, so I go in, I fill out this form, truthfully or not, doesn't matter. Then what happens?
Well, now, wait a minute. Truthfully or not, it does matter. Okay. Federal law requires you to fill the form out correctly. Anyone who lies on that form is committing a federal felony.
Okay.
18 United States Code, Section 1001, a false statement.
All right. But so, are you an unlawful user of or addicted to marijuana or any depressant, stimulant, or narcotic drug? I mean, what? Who's going to check that out?
Well, again, let's just start at the beginning. There's two sections of the form.
Yeah.
One set of questions are to identify the person so you can match up derogatory information with the person. The disqualifying questions or the qualification questions like that one are ones that are verified by the FBI through NICS. And now, are they going to catch everybody who's an addict? Probably not. But if someone's got a series of drug or alcohol arrests, then that would be something that NICS could potentially flag. And what happens then is these checks typically go through in an automated manner. In other words, so to finish your original question, which was what happens when I fill out the form? I fill out the form. I give it to the gun show or the gun store people. They match up my ID. I produce an ID, and the federal regs specify it has to be a photo ID and so on. They verify the address on the ID, verify that I'm an in-state resident, because if you're out-of-state resident, the Gun Control Act of 68 doesn't allow interstate transfers from an FFL to an individual. It has to be from one FFL to another. So they vet the thing, and then if the I answered one of the questions, quote, wrong, in other words, it said, yes, I'm a felon, then they would just say, hey, we can't process this transaction.
Okay.
Go away. But if all the paperwork is correct, then the next step is contacting NICS. And that's either – traditionally it was done by telephone where they phoned in an 800 number and would call and talk to a NICS examiner who would punch up the transaction, put in the demographic information, run the search. And then you're either given one of three responses from NICS as a dealer.
How long does that usually take?
Well, that was close to instantaneous, although there have been problems. There's been the NICS Improvement Act where they've cleaned up the response time. But typically it was supposed to be pretty close to instantaneous.
Okay. Okay.
But what would happen is it's not instant if you're talking to somebody, but it's pretty close.
Yeah.
You get either a proceed, meaning you can sell the gun. The dealer can. A delay, meaning there may be a problem, it's flagged for 72 hours, or deny, in which case the transaction's not allowed to go through, and then they would actually get a transaction number, which they would note in the back of the form. If you flip through the form, Section B is filled out by the dealer. They would actually write in the NICS transaction number to show they were denied on such and such date, and here's the transaction number.
Okay.
The reason why that becomes important is under federal law, those NICS records have to be destroyed after 6 months for privacy reasons, because otherwise that's a backdoor system of registering all gun owners in the United States and potentially the types of guns they're buying, and that's prohibited under federal law as well. And I think most Americans are rightly suspicious of the government amassing vast quantities of personal information about their habits, law-abiding citizens. And so that's troubling to people. So anyway, the NICS system, you give one of three responses, and then if it's a proceed, then you sell the gun. Now, the question about instantaneous, they've gone online now, and they do a web-based system. So most FFLs are doing this online.
Okay.
And the majority, not being a gun dealer, I can't give you a specific, but anecdotally from talking to clients and just myself going to gun stores, what I would say is most transactions, over 50%, are instantaneously approved.
Okay.
Then if you get a delay, that means an FBI examiner a NICS examiner will have to look into that and say, well, we've got another John Smith that may have a criminal record. Is it the John Smith that's in a gun shop in Columbus, Ohio?
We are talking about the history and the execution of the background checks for gun purchases, or firearms purchases, I should say, in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President Obama kicked off the new year with a plan to curb gun violence in the U.S. The plan revolves around upgrades, according to him, and background check requirements, including expanding criminal background checks to improve the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS.
We're also taking steps to make the background check system more efficient. Under the guidance of Jim Comey and the FBI, and our deputy director, Tom Brandon, at ATF, we're going to hire more folks to process applications faster, and we're going to bring an outdated background check system into the 21st century.
We're talking about how the gun background check process works today and how it might change going forward. Still with us in the studio, gun rights attorney Michael R. Moran, and by phone, director of the Center for Research in Crime and Justice at New York University School of Law, James Jacobs. Professor Jacobs, what do we know about the effectiveness of the current system as it stands?
Well, the biggest problem with the current system is that it doesn't deal with secondary sales, and that was a problem right from the beginning. So that there was a background check on a purchaser if he purchased the firearm from a dealer, but if he purchased it from a private person or a non-dealer at a bar, or, you know, or put an advertisement in the newspaper, something like that, or just did it from a website, met with the person and purchased the firearm, there was no background check. It's been estimated that maybe 40% of purchases are on the secondary market like that. You know, the system only picked up, you know, the people who went into a store, but not any of the sales on the secondary market. And so if a person was ineligible to purchase the firearm at a store, they could just put an ad in the paper and say, I'm looking for a particular model firearm, and if you have it, give me a call, and then purchase the firearm that way. So that really took the wind out of the whole idea of the background checking system.
As far as the secondary market goes, Michael Moran, when somebody sells a gun to somebody else in that secondary market, do they have to also do the transfer portion of the process?
It's a good question, and the answer is no. Just so we can explain to the listeners what you and Professor Jacobs were referring to, the secondary market is basically, first of all, understand something. Under the federal law, a transfer to someone doesn't include just selling something to somebody. If I hand you a gun, that can be considered a transfer under federal law.
Okay.
So that's why this is...
If you give it to somebody,
yeah,
for
well,
instance.
Well, no. If I'm literally standing with you and I hand you the gun and I'm letting you shoot my gun,
okay,
that could be considered a transfer.
All right.
So, for example, if I know you're a felon and I hand you a gun, I have transferred a gun to a felon, and
okay,
I'm complicit in that crime or committing my own crime under state or federal law, potentially. So the point being is this is complicated. So people say, well, we should just have universal background checks. Everybody should have a background check. Well, even something simple like that isn't simple if you consider that if I'm in a hunting party and the five of my friends, we all go hunting and somebody's shotgun goes down in bad weather and I hand them one of my shotguns and say, use it for the rest of the trip, that isn't an uncommon occurrence. Things like that happen right. all the time. That's a transfer.
Yeah.
If I know that guy's a felon and I transfer the gun to him by giving it to him, even temporarily, that's against the law. So this, I think the professor's research, some of it that I've looked at, talks about, in a way, we ought to be talking about the bigger question. Nobody thinks that dangerous people should be allowed to have access to guns. The question becomes, how much money and resources are we going to put into the idea of, quote, background checking and prohibiting people from doing things they're already prohibited from doing?
I get your distinction about what the transfer of guns is, firearms is, when it comes to what the federal law is saying.
Yes.
But let's just talk about that secondary market, though, for a second. When
sure,
people are
yes.
selling a gun
right,
to somebody.
Absolutely. What do you want to talk about
well,
with regard
I
to
mean,
the secondary market?
As far as when they do that, when someone's selling a gun to somebody, is there any facet of, not necessarily the background check, but the other paperwork that's being done where someone has to keep track of who they sold their gun to?
Great question. Let me just give you the answer and restrict it to Ohio law.
Okay.
So my expertise, Ohio law, under Ohio law and federal law, if I'm a private individual that's a lawful possessor of a gun and I want to sell it to you, another Ohio resident, let's say it's a handgun. I have a 22 Ruger that's been kicking around in my drawer that I want to get rid of, and you want to buy it, and
mm-hmm.
I know you, whether I've met you on the internet in a chat room or we're neighbors, I just want to sell you this gun.
Right.
As long as I believe you to be an Ohio resident and an eligible possessor of the gun, I can sell you that gun without any paperwork. I can basically transfer that gun to you, give it to you, loan it to you, sell it to you, and pocket the money. No paperwork, no registration, no background check. And that's been the law in Ohio, to my knowledge, since the founding of the state in 1803.
So, Professor Jacobs, if I sell my car, I have to have a title or I have to have something go with the car. I guess a registration or something like that. But if you sell a gun, you don't. Nothing necessarily has to go with the gun if you're not a licensed dealer.
That's correct.
Have there been efforts to, you know, Michael Moran has talked about how most Americans probably don't like the idea of registering guns in the same way that we say register a car. You know, with the a number associated with it and that kind of a thing. What do we know about what Americans do think about the idea of tracking firearms in that way, like we do cars?
Well, I think that there's widespread opposition to the idea of a registration system,
mm-hmm.
so that there would be a record of where of every transfer of every gun. In fact, there's been Congress has passed a law saying there can't be a registration system because of the fear that once there was a system like that, then there could be some kind of horrific incident which would lead to a confiscation of firearms, which would be much easier if there was a registration. So registration is kind of a red line. And I think there's widespread opposition. That's not even being talked about politically.
Right. When it comes to who is a gun seller, who's a licensed gun seller, what falls under that category, Professor Jacobs?
Well, the law says that if you are engaged in the business of selling firearms, then you need a license. And then you have to apply to the ATF and pay your $200, become a licensed dealer. But the law also says if you're a casual seller and you're selling from your own collection, then you don't need to be get a license, and then you don't need to go through the background checking system. You don't need so you can sell without contacting the FBI, and that's been that's the controversy at the present moment where the president says, look, there are people who are avoiding getting a license and they're selling and not putting the purchaser through the background check system, but they really are engaged in the business. But where the misinformation is that that's already a federal crime. If you are in the business of selling firearms, then you have to have a license, and if you are in the business and you don't have a license, you can be prosecuted federally for committing a federal crime. And people have been regularly prosecuted for doing that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. So what, all right, is the idea of whether you're in the business or not a personal opinion, or is there some kind of clear definition of what that means? I could be I know avid collectors of firearms who deal in them all the time. What I don't know is if they're actually a licensed dealer or not, federally licensed to do it. But Professor Jacobs, is there a definition of what we mean by in the business of selling firearms?
Well, there's a definition in the federal law. It says if you're doing it for profit and if you're expending labor at it and a few other factors, but there is ambiguity in it as to who needs a license and who doesn't. And the ATF has put out a guidance where they give examples of people. If you're selling from an estate, for example, you don't need a license, and you know. But there's ambiguity, and that's why we have trials. We've had people who are prosecuted for selling without a license, and they say, "Well, I'm not really engaged in the business." And then juries have to make the determination.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Michael Moran?
Yeah, I just read a study that was done on this subject here by one of the anti-rights groups, so I haven't vetted all their research, but there was about 400 of those prosecutions a year in the U.S. is the data that I looked at. This is going back to about 2011, 2012 time frame. And having represented both licensed and unlicensed collectors and dealers, I have represented people that have been in that situation. And
were they accused of selling as a dealer?
When they contend that they're a collector.
Right.
And the problem is, for example, under Ohio law, we have what us lawyers like to use the term bright lines.
Okay.
You know, bright lines are good for those kind of laws. If we say under Ohio law, if you sell 5 used cars a year, you're a used car dealer and you need to get a license. That's a bright line that people can understand and abide by. When you apply a nebulous standard like are you doing it for profit or are you using your labor, I think the phrase in the federal law or regulations talks about if it's your principal means of support, you know, that sort of thing. Then that gets into a whole area of what were one time referred to as kitchen table dealers. And to go back to the history again, you have to look at the history. The Brady Law in 93, following the adoption of the Brady Law and then the assault weapon ban, the Clinton administration deliberately had a policy of driving kitchen table dealers out of business. They didn't want people that sold 10 guns a year to have FFLs. They wanted them out of business. They didn't want people working out of their homes. There were a lot of retired people that had jobs that were hobbyists that had FFLs. On the side to make a little money, and mainly they were serious collectors usually.
Yeah.
Occasionally there would be a serious abuse of someone that was a gun trafficker that was, you know, deliberately breaking the law. But by and large, my experience with those people was they were hobbyists and serious collectors. The Clinton administration put them out of business if they didn't have a storefront and regular business hours and made it very difficult to get an FFL. So they drove, if you look at the numbers of FFLs, it's down substantially from the early 1990s. I find it ironic now that 20 years later, the Obama administration says, well, we want everybody to get background checks and we don't want these gun traffickers, so let's try and get everybody into the FFL system again.
James Jacobs, let's go to this larger question then at this point. Do background checks actually work? Do all of these rules and regulations, do they work? And that expanding them would just make them make the coverage more extensive?
Well, you know, work. What does it mean
for
it to work? I mean, the ultimate goal here is to keep firearms out of the hands of irresponsible people. Irresponsible being a person who's ever been convicted of a felony or of a misdemeanor domestic violence and been involuntarily committed to a mental hospital or declared mentally defective. You know, those are very broad categories. Obviously, not everyone who's ever been convicted of a felony would be an irresponsible user for the rest of their life.
Okay.
Do they work? You know, it's very easy to evade the system. It's easy to evade the system now because you can purchase on the secondary market and not have go through the background checking system at all. There's also a black market that feeds the criminal underground of people who know that they're selling to criminals, and like they're like selling drugs. So that there's a market in that. There's also stolen guns and so forth. And finally, if you know you're ineligible, you can find a friend, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, fellow gang member who is eligible, and they can buy the gun for you. That is criminal to do that, but it's certainly not uncommon.
David and Raymond, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
My question is, let's say a person made a mistake earlier in life, and they went to prison, did all their time, every day of their time, and that's been over 18 years it's been 18 years past.
Yeah.
And that still means that I could, and I didn't use a firearm in my crime. All I did, it was a domestic violence, but at any point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the rest of my life, that means I can't go hunting. And I don't. I think there should be like a statute of limitations on it. I've been out of prison since 2003 and had no more trouble. And I feel like I'm the most vulnerable person in the world because all you got to do is open up a newspaper and buy a gun.
Well, yeah, all right. So that I'm glad you brought that up. What is the legal logic, Professor Jacobs, that somebody who's paid their debt to society, they've done their time, can't own a firearm ever again?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he makes a good point. The logic of it is that if once a felon, always a felon. Mm-hmm. Once a person has committed a crime, they'll be dangerous or irresponsible with firearms for the rest of their lives. Now, that's obviously a very overbroad generalization and very unfair to a lot of ex-offenders.
Have there been challenges to that?
I'm sure there have been challenges to it, but that's it's never been overturned. The states do have mechanisms for restoring people's gun rights, and that goes state by state. And that's why there are firearms attorneys like Mr. Moran, who I'm sure handles a lot of these cases to get people get their rights to Second Amendment rights restored.
Are we talking about maybe expungement? Expungements of
Yes and no.
Convictions?
Technically, again, just talking about Ohio law provides two mechanisms for primary mechanisms for getting rid of a criminal record. One is commonly called expungement, but actually is referred to in the law as sealing.
Okay.
And that actually removes a criminal conviction from the public record, public view, and it can't be used for employment or licensing purposes. However, because Ohio has another statute that deals with the restoration of firearms rights, expungement in and of itself or sealing doesn't restore rights. And so people that have had records that they think are sealed by a judge and they were told they never had to reveal it and blah, 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 they actually will find that now they're being caught on these NICS checks and being snagged as ineligible purchasers. So, in fact, there's another procedure under revised code 292313 involving weapons under disability, which allows the restoration of civil right to own a firearm under Ohio law. The problem under Ohio law is not everyone that's ineligible to possess under federal law loses their Ohio rights. So Ohio only restricts it to violent first and second degree felons, fugitives from justice, mentally incompetent, drug dependent, and chronic alcoholics. And as a result, that restoration of rights will only work for those people that were under those disabilities. So people like this gentleman that was under perhaps a lower-level felony or a misdemeanor domestic violence cannot be restored to rights under the Ohio Restoration of Rights statute, which is very unfortunate because, as Professor Jacobs said, there are many ex-offenders that are capable of functioning in society. And we wouldn't think about letting a guy in his situation not vote or hold public office 20
years after. I think some people have thought about it, but
well, some might,
right,
but most fair-minded people would say that low-level felons that have paid their debts to society and no longer are a threat to society should be allowed to participate in civil society. Mm-hmm. And taking away a fundamental constitutional right, which involves self-defense, which is undisputed, that's the law of the land under the Heller case right now, is very troubling to me. And it's why it makes this discussion so educational and interesting, because it isn't as easy as to say we right. just have a list of all the bad people. And if we can just check the list for the bad people, we won't have any crimes anymore.
David, thank you for your call. We appreciate your time. I'll get to our other calls as soon as we can when we return to our conversation about the process of licensing and gun ownership in Ohio and the rest of the country. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you have any questions. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. When the FBI started conducting gun background checks in the 1990s, the system was intended to identify those who are ineligible to purchase firearms under federal, state, or local laws. But many see a gap in the system. Federal background checks are not required in so-called private transactions. And President Barack Obama has said he wants to close some of those loopholes. We're talking about the U.S. system of background checks, how it works, and where it falls short. Still with us in the studio, gun rights attorney Michael R. Moran, and by phone, director of the Center for Research in Crime and Justice at New York University School of Law, James Jacobs. I want to get to a question right now from Darren in Columbus. Hi, Darren. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have one quick question, and yeah. I was hoping maybe to get something else answered. But my friend told me that his father, who just turned 65, received a letter in the mail stating he had to forfeit his firearm. Because of his age, 65.
Hmm.
Now, this seems ridiculous to me, and I just wanted to.
Yeah, on its face, it certainly does. A letter in the mail, is that? Michael Moran, are you familiar with this issue?
Absolutely not. What I would say is, well, first off, there's nothing that suggests in the law, federal or local, that says that anyone loses a fundamental constitutional right at a certain age. So that's bogus. However, I think President Obama did discuss in his proposals using Social Security disability data to enhance the NICS database, quote unquote, with people that might be considered mentally incompetent.
And okay.
I think the people they're referring to are people that have what are called a representative payee. That's someone that if you're old and infirm or perhaps mentally incompetent, the person would receive your Social Security check, cash it for you, or spend the money for you, and then account to the government for the fact that they helped you out that way.
Uh-huh.
And not everyone who has a rep payee is someone that should lose their gun rights. In other words, maybe someone's just old and doesn't get out much and lives at home and wants their daughter to be their rep payee and get their money. That would be a terrible travesty. So I think, as with a lot of these rumors that get out, sometimes maybe there's a grain of truth there, and I think it's this concept that maybe they're going to use federal disability records, whether those be VA records or SSA records, to help come up with people that are mentally incompetent.
To make it more complete. But it doesn't have anything to do with age. So, Darren, I guess someone ought to get a look at that letter and double-check on that. It might be, you know.
It could be a scam.
Right. Okay, Darren, thanks for that call. I wanted to get to another issue here. Under federal and many state laws, the same people prohibited from buying guns are also prohibited from buying bullets, but virtually no systems are in place to enforce that. James Jacobs, in New York, the SAFE Act requires dealers to report all sales, such as sales of ammunition. Is that right? How does that work?
Well, it hasn't worked. They wanted to set up a database for ammunition sellers and buyers, and which would track the ammunition, and then they gave up and they announced that they couldn't do it. So it's not. Although it was in the law, they've ceased to try to implement that.
Background checks are required in the state of New York for private sales. Is this just for licensed dealers or anyone looking to sell, James Jacobs? I just want to
anyone.
Be clear.
So okay. So New York and some seven other states have tried to implement a universal background checking so that if a private person wants to sell to another private person out of their own collection, they have to take the firearm to a dealer and complete the transaction there, fill out the ATF form in front of the dealer, and then the dealer puts the purchaser through the federal background checking system.
And how does that work? How is it working, I should say?
Well, I haven't seen any evaluations. I have done some surveys of dealers, and the majority of licensed dealers say that they are complying with the system. It's not mandatory. It's voluntary whether they want to do it. They can only charge $10 for doing it. The question is how many the people who transfer their firearms to another private person bother to comply and go to a dealer to do it.
Yeah,
and
there's no way of knowing.
We don't know how much, you know, what the rate of compliance is and how many people just ignore that requirement. It would be very hard to be caught, and there's been very little in the way of enforcement.
I think Professor Jacobs makes some good points, and I think his research goes to the pragmatic aspect of this. Is we hear a lot about the phrase, quote, common sense gun regulation, end quote. I don't find that to be anything other than a wastebasket term because people use that as an argument to advance, for example, universal background checks. Mm-hmm. But yet it isn't common sense that that's a good idea. If we look at where the resources could be spent in the limited resources in our system to interdict dangerous people with guns, I would think most people would agree that dealers shouldn't be wholesaling, transferring guns in unlimited numbers to people we know are prohibited people. So I think having dealers do checks is fine. I think when you start talking about making private individuals get involved with background checking and registries, it can get very complicated and messy. And then you start saying, is there really a benefit to the end game, which is diminishing crime or protecting society?
James Jacobs, New York is one state that strengthened the mental health restrictions on gun ownership. Is that right? How did that work?
Yeah. So any medical professional is obliged to report a person who they think is likely to engage in dangerous behavior to the state, and then the person who's reported would be added to a state database, and they would be disqualified from having a firearm for 5 years, with no way to challenge that. And there have been a lot of people, thousands, tens of thousands of people who've been reported through that system and have thereby lost their rights. And if they do have a firearm, then they have to forfeit. They have to sell the firearm or forfeit it to the government. So they have to get rid of it.
Have there been?
That's a major expansion of the system.
Has there been any indication that it's been abused? Hypothetically, somebody who opposes gun rights, who's a mental health professional, abusing the system that way?
I haven't seen any charges that people are doing it for ideological reasons, but there are charges that people are doing it, you know, just on seat of the pants predictions. A person comes into the emergency room and they're very agitated and so forth, and the people in the emergency room fill out one of these forms. They want to protect themselves. Mm. You know, you don't really know who's coming through there. What if they then commit one of these atrocious mass killings? So they have every incentive to over-predict. What difference does it make to them, right? If they over-predict, and as you say, they might be philosophically opposed to people having firearms anyway.
So is there any correlation that you've been able to see between gun violence and the advent of this strengthened mental health restriction in the state of New York?
No, we haven't seen that yet. Our rates of gun violence have been pretty steady.
Okay. All right.
And you know, the one of the things that's interesting here too is what is the goal of this, And sometimes they talk about an epidemic of gun violence. I mean, that's the term the president used. But actually, gun violence is at an all-time low in the United States.
Yeah.
That's right.
Then it seemed like it was these mass shootings that is the epidemic. So those have increased.
Mm-hmm.
So is the idea that this expanding of the background check system and so on will prevent a person from who is going to engage in a mass killing from obtaining a firearm? That's very hard to do when a person is willing to commit suicide and engage in one of these atrocities. Or is it aimed at common crime? Or is it aimed at domestic violence? Or is it aimed at suicide? So, you know, the mental health thing seems to be more aimed at the at these mass killings.
Morgan in Gahanna.
Possibly a suicide.
Okay. Morgan in Gahanna, you're on the air. I'm sorry, Morgan in Gahanna, you're on the air.
Hello, my name is Morgan.
Yeah, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. I have a question for either of your participants. I want to know if there is any type of safety training that a person has to get in order to get a gun or, like, just so they know how to use it, that kind of thing. Is there an answer forthcoming?
Yeah. Michael Moran, what does Ohio require, if anything?
Well, it's an excellent question. Again, because there's no general registration of guns in Ohio.
Right.
I can buy a gun from a dealer and don't have to register it. No training just to own. But in Ohio, to have a concealed handgun license, there is mandatory training, which is now minimum of 8 hours of training.
Which has been lowered recently, right?
It went from 12 hours to 8 hours just about 10 months ago.
Yeah.
So March 23rd of last year, there was a new House bill that amended the training requirement. And now you can have 6 hours of classroom training done either online or in person, as well as 2 hours of live fire range training that meets the requirements. And a company that I work with, American Firearms Training,
mm-hmm.
onlineconcealedcarry.com, actually does provide that kind of training for people. So you can get it in person, you can get it in a classroom, but either way, you'll end up on a shooting range in Ohio if you're going to qualify for the concealed handgun license.
What was the logic of lowering the training requirement or reducing it in the state of Ohio?
I think that they looked at the requirements in other states. For example, surrounding states either had no, like Michigan, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Indiana. I think they looked at the experience of our surrounding states and saw in those states they either had they had no training requirements.
Mm-hmm.
You just had to pass a background check and get a license.
Mm-hmm.
Or they had training requirements which were not as onerous as the Ohio requirements. And I think after the 12-year or 11-year experience working with the 12-hour class, it was deemed that a shorter training class would sufficiently protect public safety.
Hmm. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi, I was just calling to say that this background check system is really inefficient. Since the Brady Bill, I have been denied the right to purchase a gun, and
Why?
No felonies. No, well, they don't tell you that. That's my concern. It's not transparent. I have no felonies, no domestic violence, no mental illness, nothing. I'm a citizen. I've not done anything wrong.
Okay.
And I've never been able to buy a gun for 10 years. And then they switched it about 10 years ago, and they just without saying anything, when I go to buy a gun, I was on the delayed list. And then I just got tired of it. So last year I started fighting it and had to file all these appeal forms. And then I had to call the FBI office. And
what do they tell you? I mean, what?
Nothing.
Nothing.
They tell me nothing.
Well, all right. Well, let's hear from Michael Moran. I mean, Michael Moran, can somebody be denied or delayed without any understanding of why?
Well, first off, yes, you're not going to know why you were delayed. I've been delayed before when I
purchased. But what about denied?
And it's because someone has got the same name as me. Like, there's two Mike Morans in the world. One's got a record. So I've been put on delay before.
Which is why I use Michael R. Moran when I'm.
Thank you.
Okay.
You're good.
Okay.
As it regards a deny, yes, you can write to the FBI and file a NICS appeal through NICS. And then once they flesh out what it is they've got on record that's causing you to be denied, you can actually correct that record, do a challenge and correction, and actually get into what's called the VAF, the voluntary appeals file, where you put the information on file. They give you a registry number. If you look on the 4473 form, if you've got a VAF number, you list it. So anyway, that's the way to handle that problem. Okay. And then you can go to federal court beyond that to appeal if they still won't give you the information.
All right, David. Thanks for that call. Thanks to Professor James Jacobs, Director of the Center for Research in Crime and Justice at New York University School of Law. Thanks so much for helping out today.
Okay, my pleasure.
And Michael R. Moran, gun rights attorney in Gahanna, thanks for joining us today to talk about it as well.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you, Professor Jacobs.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.